News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're getting a look at the first meeting of the governor's new data center advisory committee. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Dave.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Oregon Data Center Advisory Committee was created by Governor Tina Kotek in January to come up with policy and regulatory recommendations for data centers in order to pursue economic development opportunities. The committee met for the first time on Friday, February 27th. Here's committee co-chair Michael Jung, described on the committee's website as an energy and climate policy professional.
I think we're here because we all care about what is going to happen with data centers and with the state of Oregon. I think I will say that it's a conversation that many people are having, but it's also a conversation in which we're not all using the same reference points. We're not all starting from the same common understanding. We're not even using the same words to mean this, the same things. And those conversations can get really tricky. So I hope that what we do as a committee and as an exercise is to develop a shared understanding, develop a common vocabulary so that we can actually know what someone else means when they're saying something, have a mutual agreement on, what is it that we're talking about here. And that has to be the starting point if we're going to have a productive and useful conversation. With that said, this is a little bit different than how many people expect these kind of exercises maybe to run, and so we are a small group. We are interdisciplinary. Many of us are policy veterans, but none of us are data center experts, and so all of us are here to learn alongside many of you who've joined us here today. So that's our objective, and that's our mission. But at the end of the day, we will be developing recommendations, and so we have to learn fast. And we're going to be fortunate because we are learning from some of the best and the brightest in the industry, in the stakeholder community, and in our communities.
That was Michael Jung, co-chair of Oregon's Data Center Advisory Committee, speaking at the committee's first meeting. Jung has worked previously on energy policy in Oregon. In 2011, he was appointed by then-Governor John Kitzhaber to chair Oregon's 10-year energy plan. There are a number of concerns and unanswered questions regarding data center expansion, and particularly the impact on communities and the environment. The committee heard a few of these concerns on Friday from J.D. Tovey, executive director of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation.
We have lots of documentation we pulled together in kind of preparation for this, but the board didn't want me to kind of extend being involved in the committee's conversation about how we can voice our concerns and provide any kind of recommendations that may offset any of the negative impacts of data center propagation. We saw a lot of those during the conversation earlier. Those were a lot of our focuses on is, what are the impacts, making sure that we're not overtrading our resources and overtrading our space and overtrading our place in the world for something that might be short-lived. I mean, I think even more concerning was even the topic is that old data centers cannot be retrofitted. And so what happens, that's a lot of consumed land that might not be able to be reused for something very easily. So there's some pretty considered concerns around that. Some of our concerns are primarily concerns within our ceded territories. We now know that if we're in one of the top 3, 5, 10, whatever the number is in the nation, the largest bubbles were right inside of our ceded territories. So that means, so far ceded territories are some of the most hot areas of the world, apparently, in data center development, and they're probably expected that to expand. So that is something of great concern of ours, especially on impacts to tree rights and natural resource management and natural resource protection within our ceded territories. Hyperscale data centers and other data centers are primary areas of concern. We appreciate the modern landscape is moving very quickly, which in part is driving the data center boom. However, we offer that speed solely for competition's sake, seldom equates to fair and equitable distribution of cost benefits. Any propagation of hyperscale data centers in Oregon should be rooted in fairness and mutual respect. And that's everything from protection of tree rights, protection of natural resources, as well as protection of economic growth and prosperity. Come use all our resources, but somebody else in Texas is making up the money. That's not fair to Oregon, it's not fair to Oregonians, it's not fair to the natural landscape that we enjoy here in the Pacific Northwest. Any propagation of, and fair cost sharing models in place and should not occur at C2R's expense, but again, also not expensive other Oregonians and the people in the Pacific Northwest. I have lots of questions. A lot of these are more rhetorical, but some of the big ones we have, and a lot, they are not solely rooted in economics. I know today's meeting is mostly in economics, but we did want to make sure we kind of get some things on the table because it ends up kind of resulting in economic questions. Some of the, especially in the processing, talk about all the NDAs that occur with a lot of these programs, but there is seems odd to be a lack of transparency. A lot of things are buried behind NDAs. Local communities don't even know what's happening. All they know is soil starts moving. Before you know it, giant boxes start growing out of the ground, and nobody really has really understanding of what's going on or what's happening until it's already too late. So that is always a big challenging concern. And inside of these hyperscale data centers and the C2R ceded lands around the utility reservation boundaries along the Columbia River. We understand that Columbia River is a massive asset, it's a massive resource, and it's not something that should be fittered away very easily. A lot of these are driven by private interests. Landowners and counties regularly sign non-disclosure agreements that prohibit adequate release of information and set a tone that hyperscale data centers will not be transparent regarding the relationship with the communities in which they operate, leading to mistrust, which goes back to the cultural chapters, I think, that often come with these large data center locations in the world. Another item we have is the resulting pollution and noise fans. A lot of the continuation, again, people move to rural areas for rural landscapes and seeing plumes of clouds of, cooling towers or hearing the constant drone of a hum in the background, I think might be not exactly what people necessarily expect from rural areas. And then also that has impacts on even the big game, natural resources and other things like that in the Pacific. Especially within our region, it's very quiet nights, dark skies, and also there's just like a low drone in the off the distance at all times. Definitely going to be starting impacting all kinds of animals and even plants and birds. Another one is obviously treating the water as a resource to cool hyperscale data centers. It should be a conversation grounded in local values and tribal values. As state and tribal economies evolve, so do water demands, which is most impactful when use relates to non-replenishable water supplies. Therefore, evaluation of data centers sites should consider the costs related to water supply quality, as well as salmon protection efforts to increase salmon populations. Particularly where data centers are discharging water and has any change in temperature or contaminants such as PFAS, lead to the end of leaching the groundwater. We have a depressed water system, lower Utah Basin Water Ground Impact Center. I can't ever remember the acronym for that. LGWMA. LGWMA. We are hydrologists, even though the reservation has always stated that we are slowly mining our water. We have deep basalt water. We are slowly mining the water, even currently at just municipal utilization of water. So greatly increased amount of water utilization out of deep basalts wouldn't just suck water dry out of our deep basalts. While air-cooled hyperscale data centers might be an option, the amount of energy required for these data centers is extremely large. We'll tax already struggling the energy infrastructure. Some of the meetings we've already had in other forums stated that we're already like 20, 30 years behind in our infrastructure for data for energy distribution. Marty, I'm sure you have seen a lot of, so we're already like way behind on what our current needs are, much less having a massive increase. So we want to make sure that's equitable and that the taxpayer is not paying for that necessarily. If you're going to pay to play, then that's what that's should be the expectation. Tax abatements, and I know there's some of this is going on through the legislature right now. Tax abatements considered should not impact local resident energy rates or infringe upon local services. Exactly what are we selling for tax rates or tax abatements? Is it actually going to end up being net good for the organization, not just net profitable, net good? An increase in hyperscale data centers are driven in part by the increase of use of artificial intelligence. Once built, data centers are extremely hard to repurpose because of the specificities required in the initial construction. What assurances are there that data centers sited and built will not be orphaned and abandoned in this AI bubble or even just data center bubble? How will any effects of orphaned or abandoned sites be mitigated within our landscape? And then lastly, the C2IR adopted through Resolution 22067, CRICFIC, that's Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission's 2022 Energy Vision, which included Recommendation 42 regarding nuclear energy. In part, the recommendation advocates the evaluation of sites for nuclear fission reactors should consider the cost and compatibility with intermittent renewable resources and salmon protections. The power consumed by hyperscale data centers is expected to double by 2030. Where will all this additional power come from? And what measures will be taken to prevent brownouts and blackouts caused by the extreme increase in use? The C2IR has concerns that a preliminary report from the State of Washington's Data Center Work Group characterizes advanced nuclear technologies, such as small modular reactors, as potential source of both clean power that, if commercially available, would meet the forecast power needs of data centers in the state. We obviously have a disagreement on whether or not that's really clean or if anything is any green. And so there's obviously some great concerns on that, especially with the state of Oregon's current restrictions on data center, small modular nuclear reactor production, and some obviously efforts in order to be able to open that up.
That was J.D. Tovey, Executive Director of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, speaking to the Oregon Data Center Advisory Committee at its inaugural meeting February 27th. I recently attended a briefing by Cyline in order to learn more about these data centers and their impact on local communities. One of the speakers in that briefing was Dr. Xiaofan Liang, Assistant Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Michigan.
Yes, so there's many different types of data centers, and there are different ways to classify them as well. So I think the most useful mental models to think of them are three ways. So one is through the size of the data center. So the largest data centers are called hyperscaler data centers. They often occupy whole buildings or what they call campus, so that has multiple server halls that can have hosted thousands of servers, more than 100,000 square feet, and maybe using powers that's exceeding 100 megawatts. So these are the cloud factories of big tech companies like Amazon's and Google's and OpenAI. The second type is called enterprise data centers. So these are owned and operated by a single organizations. So for instance, many banks have their own enterprise data centers for data securities. So these facilities can range from 1 to 5 megawatts for smaller facilities, can up to 100 megawatts with bigger facilities. So some non-commercial research data centers may also function similarly to these data centers as well. So the third type of data center is called edge data centers. So these are smaller facilities intentionally placed closer to the end user to reduce the latency in the information transmission. And the fourth type is called co-location data centers. So you can consider these as co-working space for different data centers tenants. So basically they can rent out a space in the co-location data centers by different clients. So they serve multiple clients rather than one client oftentimes. So these are types of data center classified by scale. So the second mental model to think about them is to differentiate them by purposes. So data center used for AI trainings and inference often demand much higher levels of electricity and cooling capacity, require larger sites cluster more intensively, and thus have more interconnections with regional urban systems than general purpose data center. So the general purpose data centers are those that's used to do typical data storage. So basically these are the traditional data center that has existed for decades. So the third mental models to differentiate the data centers are by levels of redundancy. So redundancy is a term that means data center needs to provide extra independent capacity in critical systems. So these critical systems could be power, cooling, or networking. So the facility can continue operating in events of natural disaster, power outage, or even human actions. So it's very important for data center to not have any downtime, to make sure that any facility they have to have a backup. So higher level of redundancy means they need to have multiple sets of excessive infrastructure that's needed, even though most of the time they're sitting just there as a backup, but need to be there. So that this is also one of the ways that developers tend to explain why they need so much infrastructure, and they're unavoidable to local communities.
That was Dr. Xiaofan Yang, Assistant Professor of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Michigan, speaking on a briefing held by Cyline. The Oregon Data Center Advisory Committee is expected to meet at least once a month. The committee's final report is due on the governor's desk by October of this year. Reporting for KBOO News, I'm Doug McVeigh.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Many commentators have argued that podcasts were a key factor in the rise of Donald Trump. In fact, his campaign openly thanked several podcast hosts on election night for helping Trump win the presidency for a second time. Joe Rogan, who is sometimes thought of as a conservative commentator, is one of the most influential podcasters in the U.S. But researchers at New York University's Center for Social Media, AI, and Politics say Joe Rogan of the right is also Joe Rogan of the center and Joe Rogan of the left. And that, they suggest, is what makes him so effective as an influencer. KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Kylan Rutherford, a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Social Media, about the complexity of the podcast world.
The results of your research, was that something you expected, or you were kind of neutral in the beginning and didn't know what to expect?
Yeah. So our interest in podcasts kind of started right after the results in 2024. We were trying to unpack how different platforms and sources of information may have influenced the outcome. So we looked at podcasts. We knew that there was the Joe Rogan endorsement. And so the question was, a lot of the kind of communal wisdom was that Joe Rogan was pushing people to the right, and a lot of these other ecosystems were pushing people to the right, and that's why Trump was able to gain so many votes. But then as we were digging in, we found it's actually not that clean cut. You know, early on, before, you know, Trump, Rogan was actually a Bernie bro. And in a lot of these podcast channels, there is conservative stuff, and we're not, like, there are, you know, very conservative, very extreme right-leaning moments in the episodes and in the channels overall, but there's also a balance. There are a surprising amount of instances where there are very liberal takes, or at least takes and opinions that don't cleanly fit into left and right.
Well, I know that Joe Rogan was very much against what the Israelis were doing in Gaza, for example. Yeah, he was kind of identified as someone on the right, at least by the time the election rolled around. So why do you think these podcasts are so popular? Or was that, I mean, that might not have been part of your research.
Yeah, so we're trying to unpack that right now. We've been working with Edison Research. They have some great consumption data, and we're trying to understand, one, just how popular are these channels. To give you an idea of how popular Joe Rogan himself is in the ecosystem, based on the Edison data, he has about three times as many listeners and consumers than the second place show, which is Crime Junkie. So it's such a distorted space, and Joe Rogan is such a primary voice. Comparing that to music, if my numbers are right, Bruno Mars is one of the highest monthly streamed artists. If you found somebody who, like, basically the gap between Joe Rogan and second place in the podcast ecosystem is the same as Bruno Mars and spot 50 in music. So one, like, when you study and you think about podcasts, it really is all Joe Rogan. He is a huge force in the space. And one of the reasons that it's popular, and one of the things that people are trying to replicate, is Joe Rogan's model of just shooting the breeze.
Yeah, he's just this curious guy who talks to anybody, and he's just like the ordinary guy trying to find out stuff, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it stands in contrast to what, you know, the general narrative of social media has been, in that attention spans are shrinking, people want short-form video content on TikTok, and yet you get Joe Rogan who's just uncut 3 hours of talking. And it's very raw, and it's very conversational, and it generates what a lot of academics have called parasocial relationships. where the listener, they don't just listen to this person as a source of information, but they really act as if they were a friend or in their network. They respond to what they say as if they were also in the room listening and engaging in the conversation.
So are these podcasts a bigger deal than, say, radio talk shows?
A lot of people have been trying to make the case that Joe Rogan is the new Rush Limbaugh. I don't know. A lot of people still listen to radio. I don't. I definitely come from a generation that didn't grow up with that. So I understand that space a little bit less. And it's also really hard to trace. Like we can have data on monthly listeners where we know the podcast was playing in their house, but a lot of people, when we ask them, what are you doing when you listen to the podcast? They put it on the background as white noise. It's similar. You put on the nightly news. If something pops your interest, you'll peek into the room. But other than that, you're going to finish up your chore or eat dinner.
So in terms of how Joe Rogan would compare to something that's identified more on the left, like the Young Turks or the Majority Report, the latter shows would have a much smaller audience, you would say?
Yeah. So the audiences are a lot smaller. And with podcasts, it's really hard to estimate like the consumption levels, because you can get them through Spotify, you can get them through Apple Music. A lot of people have YouTube channels associated with their podcasts. And then you can go directly to what's called an RSS feed or to the podcast website and just download the audio for yourself. So it's hard to get like a clear, this one is better than the others. For example, if you look at just estimating YouTube consumption patterns, you'd get a different top 50 than if you estimated the Spotify's top 50, Apple Music's top 50, because they're just different ways. However, across pretty much all of these platforms, Joe Rogan dwarfs any of the, what we would say traditionally, like the left-leaning shows. The New York Times is the daily, is the third most popular, but the difference between that, and this is like aggregated, our best guess at like across all of these platform consumption data, Joe Rogan has about four times as many monthly listeners as the Daily.
So there's nothing in the podcast world like the Nielsen ratings used to be for TV?
So
Edison, or maybe still are, I don't know.
Yeah, Nielsen rating. We actually, my fiance and I just got an invitation to take the Nielsen survey. So we know that they're still going.
I don't know if I've ever known anyone who got an invitation.
I know. We saw it in the mail and she's like, what is this? And I'm like, I know what this is and we're taking it.
Radio has the Arbitrons.
And so Edison Research has been trying to do a similar thing as the Nielsen ratings with podcasts. I believe Nielsen is also collecting some data on podcast consumption.
Is there any data on whether it matters how long you listen to these shows?
Yeah, that's something that our lab is trying to work on right now. We're brainstorming some lab experiments that we can do to see, is it a sound bite or is it you have to be sitting down? We know with some research, Daniela Schlutz and Imke Hadar, they have been doing some work on podcasts in Germany and understanding kind of what is able to trigger this parasocial relationship so that podcasts can have, this kind of extra influence on people's opinions and behaviors. And it doesn't take a ton. You don't even have to watch a video, just listening to the audio a few times can lead to what looks like this parasocial relationship.
I hear that on radio with both political talkers and sports talk people, they have regular callers and they kind of know about their personal lives and they're kind of like friends, to a greater extent, I would say, than maybe Facebook friends, but that's a whole other subject. So do you think that your research on this is kind of groundbreaking, or have there been other researchers who have done similar work?
Yeah, we're trying to get it out as fast as possible. We know a few other teams who are working on it right now. Some of our friends, Dominique Stetchula and John Green have been working on something similar to this. There are a few other teams who are collecting podcast data. What sets us apart is we have just this massive pipeline where, we're looking at Joe Rogan, we're looking at Theo Von, a lot of these primary voices, but we're also just collecting, transcribing, and analyzing transcripts from all of the top 300 channels. And we have, as bandwidth increases, we're going to keep collecting from, the less popular ones. So what sets us apart is just kind of the magnitude. And also, rather than just looking at you know, a description of an episode or trying to look at only consumption data. We're really trying to tackle what is being said in these spaces, which is a brutal effort. My collaborator, Melina Much, has led the charge, as well as Edwin and Jason, our engineers, have really helped us to build out this collection pipeline. Because like just Joe Rogan, one episode is 3 hours and he's posting several times a week. And we're trying to understand all the way back to 2016 what's going on. And if you multiply that by 300 channels, it's a lot of audio.
And you're pretty confident in your methodology. Questions haven't been raised after that, you know, maybe you didn't do this or that right.
Yeah, we're actively kicking the tires and we're consistently getting better. What we've done to validate, we're using a lot of AI tools because of the scale to label, you know, both what topics are being discussed, whether it's about politics, the left-leaning and right-leaning. Our performance is pretty well. It's about where we'd expect. And every time a new AI model comes out, we're rerunning what we can, testing and improving. Right now, there is some noise in our measures. You know, me and my co-authors, we don't always agree, is this left-leaning or right-leaning? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes it's really hard to put it in one of those buckets or the other. And, you know, speaking of Jorgen, that's one of the things he prides himself on, is his like heterodox approach, where he's like, I don't fit on the left or the right. It's a very different viewpoint. So there are some things that even, you know, an expert human doesn't always agree which bucket we should put it in, but we're pretty confident we're getting better.
And besides Joe Rogan, what would be some of the other major podcasters that you would look at or have?
Yeah. So one of the challenging things, initially, we've been debating how we should build our like kind of focal set. We initially thought, okay, let's just pick whichever ones are rated the most popular, but we're also interested in figuring out where our key politicians going. So we started with just, let's look at all of the podcasts that Trump did an interview on in the lead up to 2024. And we keep finding them. The story was that he went to Barron Trump and literally just asked, who should I visit? Yeah. And then he worked with Dana White to set up interviews. And like podcasts that are like not even in the top 10th percentile of listeners he was on. He literally just went where young men were interested. And so we've got, you know, the batch of, we know that a lot of people are listening to these. And then we've got, where is Trump? Where did Harris go? We're looking at, you know, Gavin Newsom. We're looking at the kind of the networks of the guests. And, you know, if somebody is going on Joe Rogan, what other shows are they going on? Do we need to care about those? So it's kind of a constantly expanding and evolving list.
So would you say that TV and radio are still major players, or have they been overshadowed?
They are absolutely still players. This is definitely something new.
Not to mention the printed media. That's another story.
Exactly. Okay. Printed media, local radio. They're all different kind of consumption patterns. And one of the interesting things with our kind of fragmented media ecosystem, even if you're not listening to, even if you're not watching TV live, or you're not listening to Joe Rogan regularly, TikTok, X, Facebook, Instagram, clips from all of these sources are being posted there, sometimes with absolutely no context. So even people who we are like in our data wouldn't be a monthly listener of Joe Rogan, or, you know, watching CNN or Fox News regularly, they're still getting exposed to this content in their feeds on other platforms. All of these sources are still relevant as social media kind of shapes us into an attention economy, where interest in following news has waxed and waned over time. And so if you want people to get interested in politics, you need to find a catchy soundbite so that if they don't want to listen to 3 hours of Joe Rogan, there's a 30-second video that'll get them fired up.
Yeah, it seems like every single day people are putting out stuff. You know, what did Trump do today? And, you know, you got the woman who was the, pardon attorney for the Department of Justice. She puts out stuff pretty regularly. And there's a woman from Louisiana. What does she start her podcasts with? Well, you know. And she goes into the latest Trump kind of misadventure, whatever.
And we laugh about these, you know, starting in your kitchen recording podcasts. But like Theo Von, the host of This Past Weekend with Theo Von, he's one of the top five podcasts consistently. And that's how he started, was just like, if you go on his website and go back to his first episodes, it's just him on a computer chatting at himself.
But because of the fragmentation you mentioned, you know, a considerable sector of the population never heard of him.
Yeah. And Melina and I, my co-author, we as we've been talking about this, there are so many creators and individuals who we know by name and have listened to a lot of content by. And so it's hard to remember. Most people have never heard of them. For a subset of the population, they are key players. They're like the only person that they trust. But a lot of people have never heard of them.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
Yeah, I think the key thing with podcasts is just kind of this concept of a parasocial relationship where they really trust what they're hearing. As trust in mainstream media sources go down, trust in sources like a podcast go up. We used to, you know, trust credentials and, you know, legacy news organizations to vet and validate sources of information. And we just kind of defaulted to trusting those sources. In the absence of that, people are trusting friend relationships and one or two or three trusted voices on the internet. You know, absent any, like, I care about this X, Y, and Z credential, it's, does this resonate with what I believe?
You still have people who say, oh, it was in the New York Times, you know, I listen to NPR or whatever, mm-hmm. or, you know, they have their favorite local TV newscasters and yep. they don't want to watch the other ones.
Yeah. You know?
So same kind of thing in a way.
Yep.
That was Kylan Rutherford of the Center for Social Media, AI, and Politics at New York University, speaking with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. This has been KBOO News in Depth. Thanks for being with us.
David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.